Welcome to Conversations on Healthcare with Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter, a show where we speak to the top thought leaders in health innovation, health policy, care delivery, and the great minds who are shaping the healthcare of the future. This week, Mark and Margaret speak with Dr. William Hazeltine, Chair and President of Access Health International, a global think tank dedicated to expanding quality care to all people, a renowned scientist, entrepreneur, and philanthropist. His latest books are must-haves for families grappling with this pandemic, A Family Guide to COVID, Questions and Answers for Parents, Grandparents, and Children, and A COVID-19 Back-to-School Guide. Two important resources. Lori Robertson also checks in. The managing editor of factcheck.org looks at misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain, separating the fake from the facts. And we end with a bright idea that's improving health and well-being in everyday lives. If you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook, Twitter, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And you can also hear us by asking Alexa to play the program. Now, stay tuned for our interview with Dr. William Hazeltine here on Conversations on Healthcare.
We're speaking today with Dr. William Hazeltine, renowned scientist, philanthropist, and president of the global health think tank, Access Health International, built on the vision that all people in the world deserve high-quality, affordable healthcare. He's also the founder of Human Genome Sciences and serves on the advisory boards of the Brookings Institution and the Council on Foreign Relations.
A former professor at Harvard Medical School, Dr. Hazeltine founded Harvard's HIV/AIDS and Cancer Research Institutes. He has written over 200 peer-reviewed articles and many books, including his latest, A Family Guide to COVID, Questions and Answers for Parents, Grandparents, and Children, and A COVID-19 Back-to-School Guide. He was named one of Time Magazine's 25 most influential global business executives. Dr. Hazeltine, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, you know, I think our listeners know that you're a scientist, an entrepreneur, health innovator, and global health advocate. And you chaired the Global Health Summit in Wuhan, China in October of last year, sort of gathering some of the leading scientists in the world. I assume little did you know what was to come just a few months later as Wuhan became the epicenter of the outbreak for COVID-19. Timing is everything. I'm sure you must stay up at night sometimes just thinking, what if that was a couple of months later? But I'm wondering, as someone who is part of this larger global scientific community seeking to prevent such catastrophes like COVID-19, how did we fail, both as a country and sort of globally, in our ability to prevent this one or to better control it? How could we have addressed the response more effectively?
I'm the chair of the U.S.-China Healthcare Summit. That is an organization that was created as China reached out to the United States to help it address its issues with SARS. And in particular, it drew upon the expertise at Harvard School of Public Health and many of my former colleagues there. And from that, they would send their health experts from all over the country for a education and learning sessions. And many of the people who are managing the COVID epidemic in China were trained at Harvard specifically for that. They even went so far as to give courses to the Central Party School. So there's been a very close relationship. The other thing I would say about Wuhan, and when I think about Wuhan, I'm really sad. Wuhan's a lovely city.
Yeah.
It's a garden city. It's a big city. The three rivers have come together. It's in the center of China at the Yangtze River. It's got mountains. It's got forests. It's just a beautiful city. That's where the Sun Yat-sen Revolution began. It's where all LEDs come from, and they know it because at night the whole place is lit up. And it's just sad for me because the head of my foundation is from Wuhan. He lost three grandparents in 3 weeks in January. And couldn't go to their funerals. I was in touch on a daily basis with what was going on in Wuhan in the early days. And so let's transit from that to what's gone wrong in the United States. Things don't have to go wrong. There's nothing inevitable about what's happened in the United States. China had a big epidemic first in Wuhan. About 80,000 people got infected in Wuhan. About 4,000 people died. The numbers outside of Wuhan and Hubei province are virtually negligible. Maybe in their number, no more than 100, 200 people infected. That says something right away. They contained it to Wuhan. Now, when I think of the history, everybody hears, oh, the Chinese covered it up. They did this, that, the other thing. It is true that the Wuhan authorities covered it up for the first few weeks because they were going to have a big party congress. It was a big mistake. They got fired. Then when the central government heard about it, they shut the whole place down. If you compare the U.S. and the Chinese current epidemic, there's just no comparison. On a daily basis, 1,000 people plus in the United States get infected, are reported to be infected, and in China, it's no more than 30. When you look at the number of deaths, it's over 1,000 a day in the U.S. It's 0 to 3 in China. That's an enormous difference. With the tools we have, not the ones we're anxiously waiting for, you can squish this epidemic down to close to zero.
Yeah.
And I'm actually writing a piece right now where we analyze how they did that. I'll give you an example of how they did that. I have a good friend in a senior position, an American, who traveled from Frankfurt to Shanghai. There was one person on the plane who had symptoms. Everybody in the plane got on their cell phone a note: show up downstairs tomorrow morning, you're going to be going into mandatory quarantine for the up to 14 days from the time you stepped off the airplane. A car picked them up, hazmat clad, took them to a hotel where they were in separate rooms for the 14 days. They didn't see another human being who wasn't hazmat clad. And the only one they did see came to clean their room once a day. In that story, there is no test. There's wonderful contact tracing and mandatory controlled isolation. They had to disinfect their feces and their urine, something we don't even think about. But we know the virus can be transmitted by sewer gas. So that's the detail that they have. That's how you do it. It's so far from what we do. Mm-hmm. So even if we had the right leadership saying, you've got to protect yourselves, we just aren't simply prepared to execute at that level. The Europeans did a pretty good job. They had a big epidemic. They didn't take it seriously at first. Then they realized they had to. They forced people to stay at home. They forced people to wear masks. If you went out in France and it wasn't your hour to be at the grocery store, right, you had a $1,000 fine or yeah, more. Yeah. And the second time, you might go to jail.
Yeah.
We could do that, but we didn't do it. And so what did they do? They pushed the epidemic down to the, not down to zero a day, a couple of hundreds a day. And they're getting the infection back because you got to really push it down.
Yeah.
All the way. Mm-hmm. They're going to have a big problem this fall, and it's already showing up. You have to remember, one person started this whole epidemic.
Right.
If you have 100 people a day, each one of those can start the epidemic. And that's just the people you're catching. It's not the people who are really contagious even. You know, what I say, you need a good leader in wartime or any crisis, one who's clear, one who's credible, compassionate. Those are all things that you need in a leader. And we don't have that. Mm-hmm. Our leader is incredible, and he terrifies his political party to follow his nutty line.
Mm-hmm.
It is horrifying to see these people who I know better. They're educated in our universities. They were my students.
Yeah.
They know better,
yeah,
but they're terrified for their political lives. And I'll give you one final number. More people have died in the United States than got infected in China. And when I say that, most people say, well, you can't believe the Chinese numbers.
Yeah.
Well, I can see Chinese reality.
Yeah.
I see my friend, my people who work for me, going to movie theaters, going to restaurants, showing up at our offices to work. So that's, I think, a long answer to your question, but it covers a good chunk of ground.
Well, we appreciate that. But you know, Dr. Hazeltine, we are, though it takes my breath away to say it, we're approaching 200,000 deaths from COVID-19 in the United States. And we have this kind of looming date that is already here about the decision about whether to send kids and teachers back into school buildings that were not designed or are not equipped for this level of threat. So you wrote this book, A Family Guide to COVID, Questions and Answers for Parents, Grandparents, and Children, to give people something they are really craving, some clear guidelines for navigating these uncharted waters. What insights might our listeners gain from your book?
Well, the book is actually it's constructed in an interesting way. On the surface, it's pretty simple. But there's links that can take you right down to the primary source. So if you really want to know what all the experts have actually written, you can just link yourself right through. The other thing about this book is it's a living ebook. You buy one, and every time you go back, it should be updated.
Nice.
We're continually updating, and that's the wonders of modern publishing.
Sure.
I'll give you an idea of why that's important. In the first book, Family Guide, we changed about 25% of the questions and answers. And here's an example. If I'm pregnant, am I a higher risk? When we wrote it, the answer was no. In the second edition, the answer is yes. Why? More data. If I'm pregnant, if I do catch COVID, I'm getting seriously ill, higher. The answer originally was no. It's now yes. So you got to change as more knowledge comes in. And knowledge is just pouring in from all over the world. So I think this ebook format, a living ebook that continually adapts to understanding new knowledge. But let me get to the heart of your question. Because we failed so miserably in controlling the epidemic, first thing to realize is a pandemic is local. It's like the weather. We're used to looking outside or asking Alexa or asking Siri about the weather all the time. Think of COVID like a lethal weather. So if there's a hurricane, and the analogy is more than 25 people a day in your area getting infected, you hunker down in the basement and you don't even think about going out with your kids. So don't send your kids to school if you're in a red zone. And we have maps and we give you descriptions of how to find what your level of infection is in your zip code, in your county. Know what that is and multiply by 100 to know what your chances are of encountering somebody who's contagious. And the reason I say by 100 is we miss 90% of people in the way we test. Mm-hmm. And people are infected contagious for about 10 days. So if there are 10 people in your county, there is 1,000 times 10 people walking around contagious that your kid or you may infect.
Mm-hmm. You know, I'll pull the thread on that hyper-local levels that you're looking at, because you've also written a companion book for families, a COVID back-to-school guide, which I think perfectly timed, because you're really saying that it's really about this local environment. And I think what we're seeing now, at least with the older kids who are in college, we're seeing already a couple of schools who've said, look, we've got to postpone this. There's too much partying going on or whatever. Some schools have done it. But I want you to really talk to the parents who have grammar, elementary, high school children and really approach it in terms of keeping track of the data. There are older teachers who come in. What's generally your advice to parents right now who are really making a Solomon-like decision?
Right, and they're making it with a lot of different kind of conflicting pressures across a very broad spectrum of capability. Economic capability, can they afford daycare? Are they sending their kids to public or private school? First one is know your community. Know what the weather is outside. Know the number of people that are getting infected daily. If you're in a red zone, do not send your kid to school. Mm-hmm. If you are in an orange zone, do not send your kid to school. That might not be the advice CDC gives, it's the advice I give based on really practical understanding of what the chances you or your kid will meet somebody who's contagious. And no matter what precautions you take, you're likely to get infected. Then in a yellow zone where it is still possible to encounter somebody who's contagious, then you make two other judgments. So the first one is very clear. Am I in a red or orange zone? I don't send the kid to school. I don't care what they say they can do to protect your kid, they can't. The second thing is anybody in my family, myself, my child, or anybody living in the household at high risk for contracting and getting ill if they do contract it? Is somebody obese? Does somebody have asthma? Does somebody undergoing cancer therapy? Is somebody over 75? And you make that as your second judgment. If it's a yellow zone, the higher the risk that somebody is at risk for infection and disease, the less likely you should be to send your kid to school. Mm-hmm. And the final thing is, what are they doing to protect my child? And there's an enormous range. There was an article that came out in the Boston Globe analyzing all the things the high-end private schools in New York are doing. All schools should be doing that. But you and I know that we've under-resourced our public education. A lot of the classrooms are overcrowded. when your child's life is at stake. You should know who's in that school. There are hardworking, dedicated people, but not all of them. And you are putting your child in their care to save them from a lethal disease that could get you and your family. Especially in poor areas are not the safest environments, even when there's no disease. So it's a terrible quandary that we got ourselves into because we did not control this epidemic. And then when you recongregate, it pops up again. And that's what's happening in these universities and these colleges around the country. And it's going to be like popcorn popping. We've just heard the first pops. Wait until a lot of people go back to school. Yeah. People are going to be upset when their kids have to come home from school and can't go back. The guidelines, I think, are clear. The problem is clear, too.
Well, we so appreciate your sharing your opinions with us. And you know, one of them really is, as you just mentioned, about college and university. We've seen what already happened where parents dropped their kids off and then kind of had to go back and pick them up in a couple of states. And I guess the question is it really possible for residential universities and colleges to open up safely? Or is this really a pause year? You know, the pipeline of getting people through for all of our professions. It's a big loss to close things down for a year. What are you saying to your academic institutions at the college and university level about reopening this year?
You know, an issue that most people don't address, the need for young people to have sex. And we don't talk about it with COVID. But what are young people doing getting together? That is something you have to look at, and you look at really clearly. With AIDS, it was a lethal event. Now it might be lethal, too, just to hold hands. That's a lot scarier. And you put young people together and they can't keep themselves apart. They can't do it. And we have to recognize that. So you can say, oh, those crazy fraternity guys. Well, it's not just the fraternity guys. It's those, I can guarantee you, it's those nerds too. They have the same urges that everybody else has. And that is why it's such, especially for the high schools. I've talked to a lot of friends in writing these books. And I think maybe the funniest one is that, you know, my 17-year-old is convinced COVID is a plot to keep him from his girlfriend. You know, and that's how it feels.
Yeah.
I hear from my 18-year-old all the time. We're speaking today with William Hazeltine, a renowned scientist, philanthropist, and president of the global health think tank, Access Health International. He's founder of the Human Genome Sciences. He's written over 200 peer-reviewed articles and mini books. And his latest, A Family Guide to COVID, Questions and Answers for Parents, Grandparents, and Children. You know, we've had a number of guests on the show who've really been speaking about this accelerated pace of research and scientific discovery that's associated with this pandemic. And you yourself were really on the forefront of genomic research that led to the development of drug protocols now used to control HIV and AIDS. And I'm just wondering how you look at, one, the vaccine development, and then the second, what are the unintended discoveries that might be coming out of all of this research, foundational level of new discoveries that might be out there?
For me, it's like a summary of all the things I've done in my career, from fundamental molecular biology right through to public communication and the interaction between universities and pharmaceutical companies, drug development, et cetera. I've developed drugs for infectious diseases. I developed the drug to protect us from an anthrax attack. And actually, it was the first drug following 9/11 that our new legislation allowed us to do. We had legislation in place that made it possible from idea to FDA approval in 2 years. Yeah, you know, I don't know if that's warp speed, but it's pretty darn quick because we put in a whole pathway for accelerated development that would protect us against bioweapons for which we had no defense. And it was my post office that got attacked. I used to teach a course on anti-chemical and biological warfare. I know about this stuff. Put together a group, and in 2 years, we had a drug, had it approved to protect us against anthrax. So I've been here and seen how it's done. But vaccines are really a little bit different category from most drugs. And the reason for that is you're treating people who are fully healthy, young people, old people. And who is most vulnerable to this disease are the older people. But it's also a special problem because this gets in through your nose.
Right.
But anybody who's fought AIDS hand to hand like I have for a long time comes to respect the virus. The natural history of HIV, it gets in you. You make a huge immune response, T cell, B cell, every kind of cell, mm-hmm. and you don't stop it. The question then was, why do you think a vaccine is going to stop it? But we still, 35 years later, yep. have not figured it out. How about COVID? The virus is a coronavirus. We know they have a special trick. They get into you, and a year later, the same guy comes back and gets you again and gives you another cold. That's nature. I can tell you, if you're an immunologist and you look at what's happened to the people who are infected with this virus, it's screwy. And if you look at SARS, there's 9 different proteins we already know about that mess with your immune system. And some of them mess with it in 2 or 3 different ways. The one thing that we don't have is the 35 years of research that we have on HIV/AIDS for coronavirus. We just didn't do research on coronaviruses. Yeah. And we had a brief flurry around SARS, and then the people couldn't get funded anymore to do the work.
Right.
How does each one of these, at least 9 and probably 12 viral proteins, mess with your immune system? And what does that tell us about the immune system and how it controls itself? Mm-hmm. HIV taught us fundamental things about how cells do things, and viruses just adapt to that. It turns out that the AIDS virus has a special way of getting its messenger RNAs from the nucleus to the cytoplasm. There's a protein that the virus makes that actually attaches to signals. It's a whole level of regulation. We had no clue happened. We'll get the same harvest when you go deep into these viruses. I'll give you another puzzle. When you do a PCR test, you're measuring genome RNA. And one of the big puzzles is you can measure genome RNA for many weeks after infection, but you can't find viruses more than 10 days afterwards. What's going on? They can't be detritus RNA, sort of fragments, because they don't last very long. These things keep on going. There's a mystery. The way we test is cockamamie. We use a very expensive, research-oriented, therapeutically-oriented test to screen. There's only a short period of time when you make enough virus that you're contagious. And you don't need the most sensitive instrument in the world, PCR. You can do that with something equivalent to a 5-minute, 10-minute pregnancy test. It should cost 50 cents and take 15 minutes. Yeah. So everybody takes it every day if they want, before they go to school. Why don't we have those? We could have made them long ago. Factory can produce 100 million a day. Those are what we should have. So you spit on a little card, and you check 15 minutes later the color, and you know if you're infected or not. That's coming, but why don't we have it now? Another major failure, and it's a conceptual failure. I mentioned earlier we would probably miss 90% of the infected people by testing the way we test now.
Well, Doctor, I wonder if I could just pivot for a moment to talk about a reality that you have sought to address throughout your long career, and that's the deep inequities that we have in access to affordable, quality health care for a large sector of the world's population. You're the co-founder of Access Health International, a think tank dedicated to leveraging scientific discovery and technology that improves access to quality health care for all people. And we would welcome your sharing your vision that drives that work.
I've always been interested in global health. And as a molecular biologist and then drug developer, tried to find some way it would be comfortable for me to work on that, on those problems. And also driven by the realization that there were so many wonderful opportunities in science that I could see open up through my lifetime of work in the genomic work, the precision medicine, the use of robots to speed the work of drug discovery. I mean, just fantastic things we can do. And really every year, there's a new chapter opened up of wonderful technologies that speed our ability to understand, treat, and cure disease. And my fear was that as prices in the United States and health rose and people didn't have the benefits of the investment we were making, the impetus to continue that discovery would fade. And I think we've seen some of that. And even though our budget of NIH is very healthy and it should be what it is, it's something that's bipartisan and it's, I think it's one of the best things we do, it's not a guarantee. And I was really worried about the fact that in the United States, there are many people who are going to say, I'm not benefiting from this research. And then if you look around the world, you understand that in most parts of the world, getting access to good health is not about getting the latest drug. It's about getting any drug. It's about getting access to any doctor. I was on a board of a place called One World Health, and we developed an old antibiotic to treat visceral leishmaniasis in India. It got approved in India. However, nobody ever was benefited from that because where it was needed, Bihar had no infrastructure to deliver it. You have a region of the world that needs it. You solve the problem conceptually, but not practically. And so those experiences led me to say, it's really important to get the whole health system right. And so we started doing research. And the way I did the research was to find what works best around the world. What is the best health delivery system? Highest quality, lowest cost. Answer, clear, Singapore. 1/4 of the US cost and the top 5 in the world in outcome. So I wrote a book about how they did it. I tell you the reaction. I gave it to Mayor Bloomberg, and he's got a good sense of humor. I handed him the book. He said, why did you write it? I told him, he said, what makes you think people want to know? Okay, that is a pretty profound comment when it comes to these kinds of books. If you look around the world, you find some great examples. And you look in this country, you see great examples. And I believe that from years of doing deals, collaborations, talking to governments, that if you are lucky enough to have the right information, you can find people who've already decided they need it. And I've come to the conclusion, I can't influence anybody's desire to do something, but if they have that desire, I can help them do it.
Great. We've been speaking today with Dr. William Hazeltine, Chair and President of Access Health International and author of a just released A Family Guide to COVID, Questions and Answers for Parents, Grandparents, and Children, and a COVID Back to School Guide, two extremely important resources for families navigating everyday life through this pandemic. You can learn more about his work by going to accessh.org, and you can find his books at the website, William Hazeltine. Dr. Hazeltine, thank you so much for the scientific research and discovery you've brought, but also today for your clear and consistent message and the compassion that you bring to everything you do, and also for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare.
Well, thank you very much.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
President Donald Trump exaggerated Americans' comparative success battling the coronavirus, falsely saying in a press briefing that the U.S. per capita death rate is lower than most of Western Europe. The president made his comments in an August 10th press briefing at the White House, saying, quote, we have fewer deaths per capita than the United Kingdom and most other nations in Western Europe and heading for even stronger numbers. Trump is right that the U.S., which has had about 50 deaths per 100,000 people, has a lower per capita death rate from COVID-19 than the U.K., which has had 70 deaths per 100,000 people. But he's wrong when he adds the same is true of most other nations in Western Europe. According to statistics compiled by Johns Hopkins University, the U.S. has done better on cumulative per capita deaths than Belgium, Spain, the U.K., Italy, and Sweden, as well as two tiny microstates, Andorra and San Marino. But the U.S. also has done worse than France, Ireland, the Netherlands, Switzerland, Luxembourg, Portugal, Germany, Denmark, Monaco, Austria, Finland, Norway, Iceland, and Malta. The following day, Trump altered his claim during a press briefing to exclude the New York tri-state area from the nation's per capita death figures. It's not clear why the president would remove New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut from the country's statistics and then compare the per capita rate to other countries that aren't being given a similar handicap. While Trump says that the U.S. is heading for even stronger numbers, it's worth noting that deaths per capita will only grow for nations as more deaths accumulate in ongoing outbreaks. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, Email us at chcradio.com. We'll have factcheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare. Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. When Wichita, Kansas nurse practitioner Michael Warzewski learned of the harsh and often fatal conditions that expectant mothers endure in sub-Saharan Africa, all because they live too far from a medical clinic, he thought there had to be a way to fill that need. He came up with a solution, Clinic in a Can, transforming shipping containers into fully equipped mobile clinics and operating rooms that can be shipped anywhere in the world where there is a need.
When you walk in the inside, you will believe or think that you're inside the clinical environment for which maybe you're an emergency room or an ICU unit. They look exactly the same.
Warzewski learned from his early iterations that gas-powered generators could be problematic in low-resource areas and switched all of his portable clinics to solar power, which he says was a game-changer.
There's no part of the world that does not have sunlight. And so solar power has become the cornerstone of how we power our clinics, so that now every piece of equipment, including the air conditioners, we can run it off of 500 watts of electricity, which means six solar panels on the top is enough to run a clinic for 18 hours.
Since its founding a decade ago, Clinics in a Can have been delivered to war-torn Sudan, to earthquake-ravaged Haiti, and more recently to Santa Rosa, California, an area decimated by the wildfires that also destroyed the main community health center there. Santa Rosa Community Health Center CEO Naomi Fuchs says that the portable clinic provided a lifeline for her patients and was a godsend for her providers.
These have been an outstanding way to respond to emergencies, to set something up very quickly.
The roughly 120 square feet shipping container clinics are designed to become a permanent fixture in low resource areas.
We equip it with the best equipment, and we ship it as a completed project that once on the ground, within 20, 30 minutes, it's ready to be used.
Clinic in a Can, fully equipped with medical and surgical equipment, ready for deployment to anywhere in the world, providing quality, state-of-the-art medical facilities in a low-resource area. Now that's a bright idea.
You've been listening to Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare is recorded at WESU, at Wesleyan University, streaming live at chcradio.com, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts. If you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love hearing from you. The show is brought to you by the Community Health Center.